The Financial Sense Midweek Edition with Jim Poplava. Delving in-depth with authors and experts into the key economic issues.
Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's edition of Lifetime Income.
And I'm John Loeffler. Our guest this week is Adam Sherry, and the subject will be estate planning for everybody. You don't have to be necessarily uber rich, single, married, young, old, lots of bucks, and maybe not so many bucks. You can actually plan an estate. And what we're going to do for today's program is piggyback on the theme of last week's show, which was maximizing Social Security. We're going to look at Social Security benefits this week for women, whether you're single, divorced, or widowed, how to plan, what are your benefits, and even if you are not single, what is the best way to plan so that benefits are maximized, as we covered on the show last week statistically, whether you're looking at age 62, 66, or 70, because statistically, women outlive men 3 to 4 years. That's not fair, but that's the way it is. So if you are a woman, you are more than likely to be the survivor of a long-term marriage. So, Jim, where do we begin?
Well, let's look at several facts that have been published by the Department of Social Security, and these really stand out. When it comes to women, you mentioned the first one is that women have a longer life expectancy, and more likely you're going to outlive your husbands. So that works against them because they live longer. In addition, they are in and out of the workforce more often than men, so this reduces their average wages. You know, they take time off to have children. And for some, that can be a considerable amount of time. Now, you got to remember, if you're a woman and you don't work, let's say, 1 year, Social Security bases your benefit on the average you earn over a 35-year period. So if you don't work a year, a zero gets included in the average, which basically lowers your Social Security benefits in the long run. And finally, they tend to earn less than men. So you got all three factors impacting women adversely. And here are a few stats about female beneficiaries. Number one, they are 61% of the benefits. In fact, we'll get into some stats later on. If you look at survivor benefits, women make up 83% of survivor benefits of Social Security. So you live longer, which means you're more dependent on Social Security over a longer period of time. You make less and you're in and out of the workforce, which means your benefits are going to be much lower. So the strategies we're going to talk about here is how to correct some of these discrepancies between, let's say, what your husband or what men make and what women make. And it's really important that you do some planning because there's so many mistakes that are made in terms of filing for Social Security benefits. And that's why I want to cover this. There was a report that just came out from the Social Security Commission revealing all these statistics that, you know, a vast majority of Americans take it at age 62. They think, you know, it's not going to be there. I might as well get my benefits now. And they don't realize they are shortchanging themselves in terms of their benefits over the lifetime of their retirement.
You know, these are really sobering facts when you look at it. I mean, if you consider that women make up the majority of all Social Security beneficiaries because of the, not just demographics, but because of actuarial type tables. So what benefits are women entitled to?
Well, let's begin with the first benefit, which is a woman's own retirement benefits. As we discussed, the reality is that women don't typically have the same work histories or earnings as men do. So their retirement benefits are usually lower because, once again, the benefit is based on an average of work over 35 years. Now, here's a fact that will stand out. Of those 35 years, according to the Department of Social Security, women have, on average, 13 years of zero. What that means is in a 35-year period, they skip work 13 years. So out of 35 years, they only work, let's say, 22 of those 35 years. Every year you don't work, a zero gets included in the average. And all this adds up to a gender gap in retirement. For example, For women retired, the average Social Security benefit for men is $1,494. For women, it is $1,174. So almost $300 difference. For retired men who are disabled, the average benefit is $1,289. It's a little over $1,000 for women. Spouses of people that are retired, it's a little bit higher for women because they're getting roughly 50% of their husband's benefit. And for widows, it's a little bit higher because, once again, they're getting their husband's Social Security benefits. When a husband passes away, the wife has the choice of taking the larger benefit, either her own or her husband's. So these are just some of the stats out there. And as shown in these stats, your benefits are going to be typically lower. Now, we'll talk later how to maximize those benefits if you are married. But if you worked 10 years, you paid into the system 40 quarters, you are entitled to your own Social Security benefits.
Right, let's move on to spousal benefits because the vast majority of women are married or were previously married, so they are entitled to spousal benefits.
Yeah, the basic rules here are if a woman is married and her own Social Security benefits are less than 50% of her husband's benefits or what they would be, or let's say she has no benefits at all, let's say she never worked, she was a stay-at-home mom, she becomes eligible for a spousal benefit. The benefit is generally equal to half of her husband's benefits. Now, here's important, at her full retirement age. So for most women today, that full retirement age is going to be either age 66 or it's going to be age 67. Now, the amount would be less if taken before retirement age, just as if you retire at age 62 and take your benefits, they're going to be less if you wait to your full retirement age. The same thing applies to the spousal benefit. If you take your husband's spousal benefit at full retirement age, you will get 50%. If you take it at age 62 when you're eligible, it'll be less. And there are ways to fix that if the earnings between the spouses is not a major factor, which we'll talk about in just a minute.
Okay, well, let's move to another situation. Some marriages end not in death of one of the spouses, but in the case of divorce. So if we take the case of a divorced woman, is she entitled to anything? If so, what is she entitled to, and what are the rules and guidelines?
A divorced woman is also eligible, believe it or not, for spousal benefits, but only if her marriage lasted at least 10 years. So there's a 10-year requirement. And secondly, she remains unmarried. And third, she is at least age 62. So three requirements if you're divorced. Your marriage had to last 10 years. You still remain unmarried and you're age 62. This benefit has no effect on the benefits of a divorced woman's former husband. If your former husband gets married, you're still eligible for benefits on your former husband, even if he marries another woman. So a divorced woman earned benefits through her own work history. So she always has that available, as well as through spousal eligibility if that is larger. She's considered, John, if you're divorced, you're considered duly entitled. So if she qualifies for more than one benefit, she will receive the benefit amount that is higher, either her own benefit or 50% of her husband's benefit. So even divorced women are entitled to Social Security benefits. And it doesn't matter if you've been divorced for 10 years, as long as that marriage was 10 years in duration, you are going to be entitled to your former husband's Social Security benefits at age 62 if you remain unmarried. So three requirements are marriage lasting 10 years, two, you remain unmarried, and three, you are age 62.
Okay, and so if she marries again, then that changes her whole situation in relationship to her new husband.
Exactly. And there, if something happens to that husband, the marriage must have lasted at least 12 months. So let's say you get married and your husband dies within, I don't know, a couple of years. As long as the marriage lasted 12 months, you could be eligible for your deceased husband's Social Security benefits.
Yeah, just don't marry a deadbeat. you know, so then you're in good shape there. Okay. Let's move on to the last situation, which is the subject of survivor benefits. Since according to the Department of Social Security, women make up over 80% of the beneficiaries who are receiving Social Security, which highlights the importance of Social Security benefits for the surviving widow.
Now, when the husband dies, usually what happens is the widow switches from her spousal benefit to her husband's, because typically the Social Security is larger. But here's the thing, John, she gives up her own spousal benefit and starts receiving her husband's. Now, if a woman is divorced and her husband worked long enough to receive benefits, she is eligible for survivor benefits as long as, once again, the marriage lasted 10 years. However, if your husband dies, the age requirement drops from age 62 to age 60 in 50 if the woman is disabled. So if she has been receiving benefits as a survivor and reaches full retirement age, she can switch to also her own retired benefit in that time if it is larger. And there's some times where that makes sense. You may get a spousal benefit, but let's say you allow yours to compound and grow at 8% to age 70. You know, at age 70, you could switch over to your own retirement benefit if it is larger at that time. So there's a couple options there available for a surviving spouse.
Now, the problem as a widow is that you now lose one source of income, which is your spouse's source of income, his benefit. So widows do experience a loss of income, which can very seriously affect their lifestyle and their expenses. And not only is it a traumatic time in terms of emotional loss, but then you have some major readjustments that may be encountered here.
Yeah, you bring up a very good point that should be taken into consideration when doing your retirement plan, is to provide for that loss of income or to maximize your husband's Social Security benefit so that it becomes a larger benefit to you, the surviving spouse. Which brings me back to a strategy we explored last week on the program on Social Security, which is called file and suspend. So I want to touch upon it here because it is worth repeating that strategy here. And the way it works is, let's say your husband reaches full retirement age at age 66 or 67 for some that are born later. He files for Social Security benefits, but then he suspends them, which enables his wife to begin receiving her spousal Social Security benefits. Meanwhile, because he suspends his benefits are going to grow at a guaranteed rate of 8% a year until age 70. So when he reaches age 70, his Social Security benefit will be 132% of what his benefit would be at age 66, which in the end will provide a much higher survivor benefit to his spouse. Because as you mentioned, John, for a typical couple, husband is receiving his Social Security benefit. The wife is receiving her spousal benefit, which is 50% of her husband's. But what happens is when the husband passes away, all of a sudden now, one Social Security check is going to be eliminated. And the survivor can choose between keeping her own benefit or that of her husband. Typically, she'll take her husband's because it's a larger benefit. Well, what you want to do with this strategy is you want to make sure that the husband's benefit is as large as it can be. That way, if you become a widow, you are going to get a larger Social Security benefit than you otherwise would get. So if, let's say, your husband files and suspends at age 66, his benefits grow 8% a year to age 70, at which time he now gets 132% of what his benefit would have been at age 66. Well, what does that mean for you, the widow? That means you would get that 132% benefit. So it's another strategy to maximize benefits. And the other thing you could be doing, depending how close your income is, let's say if husband and wife were both professionals during their working career, maybe let's say the husband was a doctor, the wife was a nurse or a very highly skilled professional. Maybe her husband made more money, but she also made a good living. Maybe you could be a nurse practitioner where you're making close to seven figures a year. In that case, what you want to do is have your husband file and suspend. So his Social Security check is going to grow by 8% a year, or 32% at age 70. And then what you do is file and restrict, which means you get half of your husband's, but you allow your own benefit to grow at 8% a year. So at age 70, who knows? It could be larger than your husband's. You don't know. But anyway, it's one strategy, and this allows the couple to maximize both their Social Security benefits while they're both living after age 70. But the wife can switch to her own benefits if they're larger at age 70. The husband and wife then get 132% of both their benefits. More importantly, if the husband passes away first, the surviving widow would get a much larger, higher survivor benefit as a widow.
You know, this all emphasizes once again the point that decisions regarding Social Security should be made jointly, with all of the options being explored. Choices made can have major impact on a couple's retirement income, and especially for wives who make up the majority of beneficiaries receiving Social Security benefits. So we always come back to this point. Another reason why you want to have a plan, it's as we discussed last week, it can literally make a difference of hundreds of thousands of dollars over a retirement lifetime. It's very important to understand this, to look at these benefits.
Yeah, it's one of the reasons we wanted to cover this topic in the last 2 weeks, because I have continued to see poor choices, John, made when it comes to receiving Social Security benefits. The biggest one is taking benefits too early at age 62. You're roughly going to get about 70% of your benefits. The other mistake is not maximizing benefits for a surviving spouse. As we've talked here in the last 2 weeks, statistically, women are going to outlive men. So they're going to live longer. They're going to be dependent on that. And then secondly, as a result of outliving their husbands, they're going to lose their own spousal benefits or their own benefits, because usually their husband's benefits are larger. So women are a main survivor. They're the main beneficiaries. 83% of beneficiaries are women. They become widows generally at an older age. When their husbands die, they lose their own spousal benefits. This may occur, John, at a time when they are spending a lot more on medical expenses. So a major loss of one spouse's Social Security benefit could seriously impact retirement lifestyles.
So outside maximizing benefits for survivors through file and suspend or file and restrict, what other options are then available?
Well, I mean, we see a couple options. A lot of times life insurance would be one option, John. Usually I recommend a husband keep his life insurance policies if they're like universal life or whole life. The only time I don't recommend that is if they're term policies. But once again, that also even depends on the health of the husband. Another one is allowing IRAs to compound is another option. So there are more assets later on. These are the kind of scenarios that really should be modeled and addressed in a retirement plan, because you're not thinking about that when you first get retired. So when you look at a retirement plan, it should include not only, hey, can I retire and can I live comfortably? It's not just when you just retire. It's also thinking of the three phases of retirement, the beginning of retirement, the mid years, and then the latter years when you're spending a lot more money on medical expenses and, God forbid, long-term care. And when you look at these strategies and incorporate them, that way you are going to maximize your Social Security benefits for yourself as well as your spouse, and you're prepared for the inevitable when it arrives.
So if we sum all of this up, this is the checklist you want to go down when you're beginning to do Social Security planning for women. Number one, women are entitled for four benefits. So number one, that's their own worker benefit based on their own working career during their lifetimes. Then number two, the spousal benefit can be taken if it is larger. Three, survivor benefits at age 62 or 60 if divorced. And four, a disability benefit, which begins at age 50. And the key here is try to maximize the benefit. And you can use file and suspend or file and restrict to maximize benefits for survivors and for both of them while they're living. So it's not as complicated as you might think, but you do have to look at it and understand what your options are to make the right decisions. Now, what we usually do every week here on Lifetime Income is use a real-life case study. We change the names of the people involved to protect their privacy, but it is a real-life event. So whom do we have this week? And I'm assuming you're going to be talking about maximizing Social Security.
Yeah, in this case, our case study this week is Tom and Sandy Benson. Tom is age 65. He'll be retiring at the end of the year. His wife, Sandy, age 59. Here was a situation where we wanted to maximize Social Security benefits because of the level of assets and income. Assets, they had roughly about $300,000 in cash. A lot of that came from just sitting in the markets, basically from the sale of the house. They downsized, got a smaller home. They sold the big house, and they had money left over, which gave them a house that was free and clear. Their home, valued about $600,000, free and clear, no mortgage. Tom, when he rolls over his 401k program at the end of the year, that'll be about $750,000. Tom's IRA was $79,000, Sandy's IRA $46,000. So their total assets, including their home, was roughly over $1.8 million. Their investable assets were roughly about $1.25 million. Now, looking at Social Security benefits, Tom's full retirement age, 1 year away at age 66, his Social Security benefit would be roughly about $2,450 a month. Sandy's benefit at age 66 from her own work history would have been $1,250 when she reaches full retirement age, which would be 7 years from now, would be $1,250. The expenses were roughly $50,000 a year. Travel expenses for the RV and traveling to go see the kids, about $8,000. So total expenses were roughly about $58,000 a year. Now, we needed to wait 1 year for full Social Security benefits for Tom. And we suggested maximize Social Security benefits, especially in the fact that we had a 6 year difference in age between Tom and Sandy. You add to that 3 to 4 years of life expectancy greater for Sandy than for Tom. So you had a 10 year difference there. So we wanted to maximize survivor benefits. The problem is we did not have enough assets. They had roughly about $1.25 million investable assets. If you take a balanced return between stocks and bonds at close to 4%, that would have been $44,000 a year. Tom would need Social Security to make his budget because we would have a shortfall of $29,000. And we also ran into problems in the latter years.
You know, Jim, you have to think about this. You just don't imagine that a millionaire with a home free and clear as well. So one of the big expenses of every month living is gone. Would have a financial problem. I always wonder, like, how do Hollywood stars with everything they make get into trouble? You know, it's the same deal.
Well, welcome to California, financial repression and inflation. So, I mean, the typical definition of the millionaire in California is a homeowner.
All right, Mr. Magician. So what would you recommend now to these people?
Basically, out of cash, we recommended $250,000 in an immediate annuity. So in effect, we were creating a pension because we had a shortfall of income. And that would have created a total income of close to $14,000 or about $1,150 a month. Investing the 401k program, rolling it over into an IRA, 60% in bonds and about 40% in stocks. Now, we went more into bonds because we needed to get more income initially, but that would only be for about a 3 year period until Sandy was able to take her spousal benefits. That would create $44,000 of income. You combine that with the annuity, and we roughly had the $58,000 to take care of basic expenses and travel. However, at age 66, when Tom was eligible for his Social Security, he would file and suspend. And the big difference here is his benefit of $2,450 a month would grow guaranteed to $3,333 a month at age 70, or roughly $40,000, a big difference for Sandy if she became the survivor. Secondly, we recommended that Sandy take spousal benefits at age 62, which would be roughly $1,543 a month. That would be an additional income of $18,500 a month. And then eventually, once Sandy started to receive her spousal benefits, we would begin to shift more of the assets into stocks because of longevity, not only for Sandy, but also the inflationary expenses. You laughed, John. You said, you know, here's a couple that has a free and clear home and over $1.25 million to invest, and they had financial issues. Well, that's the world we live in today, in low interest rate environment, financial repression, and inflation. And remember, we covered this on a previous program. The government has come up with its own CPI index for retired couples, and it tends to run almost 6% a year, most of that due to increasing healthcare costs. So we would eventually shift part of that portfolio more into stocks with inflation. 3 years from now, when Sandy's receiving their Social Security benefits, we figured, let's say, a 5 or 6% growth rate on the dividends of the stocks, but stocks were a smaller percentage. Portfolio income should be roughly about $48,000. The annuity would be $13,750. Sandy's Social Security spousal benefit of $18,500. Their total income would be over $80,000 a year, roughly $22,000 more than their present budget. But John, here were the moves that we had to do because to begin with, we had a problem. There was a 6-year age difference between Tom and Sandy. Add to that, that Sandy's likely to live by 3 to 4 years longer than Tom. So what we really wanted to do here is maximize Social Security benefits by Tom using a file and suspend strategy. But by doing that, he was going to forego that $2,450 a month. So how did we make that up? We did it by creating an immediate annuity to, in effect, create a pension for both Tom and Sandy. And then file and suspend, which would maximize Tom's Social Security benefits, which would be larger for Sandy, that she would receive as a widow. Once Tom passes on, assuming Tom's going to be the first to go, statistically, which is a high probability. And then secondly, to get that income up, and what we would do is Sandy, at age 62, would file for spousal benefits, about 70% of Tom's benefit at that time. So this is basically a file and suspend strategy to maximize Social Security benefits for the survivor.
So it was successful, and planning and directing where you're headed always has a positive effect if you understand the situation in which you are operating. Coming up next here on Lifetime Income, Adam Sherry, estate planning for everybody, single, married, young, old, lots of bucks and not so many bucks. All of that coming up next at FinancialSense.com.
You're listening to the Financial Sense Lifetime Income Program. To speak to Jim Poplava or his Lifetime Income Specialists, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized retirement portfolio.
Most individuals and families, when they think about doing financial planning, don't think about estate planning. Your young family starting out, well, you know, getting old is further out in the distance, but you should have some kind of an estate plan, even if you're single or even just getting married, or if you're one of those fortunate few to have a lot of money. Joining us on the program is Adam Sherry from Anderson & Yoakum. And Adam, I want to begin with, let's just take a young couple out of college. They're getting married, maybe thinking of starting a family. Most young couples today, they could be in their 20s, early 30s. The last thing they're thinking about is if something should happen to them. So they're not thinking about estate planning. But let's take a young couple starting out today. What should they have as a minimum, and preferably what would be the ultimate estate plan they should put in place beginning their life as a married couple?
That's a great question about a group, as you said, that doesn't spend much time thinking about estate planning. I feel like one of the biggest motivators for them to be thinking about their estate plan is kind of a negative one, actually, and it's probate. And so the idea of making sure that they can avoid the probate process is really one of the great motivators that they should have, despite the fact that they may not be, you know, too concerned about their own mortality at this point. Now, probate, as we've talked about before, is primarily a problem and something to be avoided because, A, it's a public proceeding, B, it's very time-consuming, and C, it's expensive. You know, for instance, at least in California, where I practice, probate on an estate, you know, let's say that it was about $1 million, attorney's fees can be up to $23,000 just to get your assets through probate. And so the key estate planning documents that this couple that you've profiled should have is something that enables them to avoid the probate process with respect to their assets. And so that's just a basic living trust. The purpose of the basic living trust is to make sure that they can avoid the probate process. And so, you know, a lot of your listeners may not be aware of this, but having a will is great because it allows you to identify who you want your assets to go to. But beyond that, you're going to have to probate it to get those assets to the beneficiaries that you've identified. So that really just brings into focus the utility of a probate avoidance trust. Now, you know, briefly, the only other major document that's definitely worth considering is a durable power of attorney for asset management. Now, if one of these two has a serious, let's say, car accident and is in a coma or, you know, has some serious injury and they're unable to take care of their own business, well, you know, the mortgage payment still needs to be made. You know, they still need to be able to collect on money they maybe owe if they're running their own business. And so identifying somebody who can act on your behalf through a durable power of attorney for asset management is the other main document to focus on.
You know, I'm thinking of two other issues, and I want to talk about a recent case that was brought to our attention, but also let's talk about a young couple that are starting out, and let's say they don't have assets. Let's say they just got married, they're living in an apartment, they don't own a home. Maybe they have some 401k programs at work, but as a result of being at work, they have life insurance policies that either the company provides or, let's say, with their own planning, they have life insurance. And especially if they're starting a family and maybe having children, they may have life insurance policies that, you know, that could mount sometimes into the seven figures.
You know, absolutely. And life insurance is a really prudent, great way to use money, particularly for this given couple, given how affordable term policies can be in some of these cases, or even a whole life policy. And so when we're talking about that from a planning perspective, it's all about beneficiary designation. They need to make sure that they've appropriately executed that beneficiary designation, which identifies the person who's going to receive the death benefit, you know, if that person were to pass away. And when doing that, they need to take a moment to think not just about the primary beneficiary who, you know, oftentimes would be the other spouse, but they should be thinking about secondary and tertiary beneficiary designations as well. And, you know, keeping in mind that if they have young children, they're going to need to identify somebody who can serve as a guardian for that child's assets, because if money is payable to a minor, it's likely going to be put in a restricted bank account that'll be held for them until they turn 18. So when filling out that beneficiary designation, it's worth remembering the secondary and tertiary positions, but then also if they mean to benefit a minor, to identify somebody who can manage those assets on behalf of that minor.
Okay, let me take this a little step further. When you're talking about maybe something happens to one of the couple, let's say that something happens to the husband. We had a situation with one of my clients where his daughter and her husband were both killed in a car accident. So in this case, both mom and dad die prematurely, life insurance proceeds, and young kids. What do you do in that circumstance? And what would be the best way to plan for, you know, tragically, if something like that would happen?
So I would say one of the best ways to be able to give a complete description of how, you know, mom and dad might want to provide for their children would actually be through a trust. That's one of the most useful vehicles when it comes to giving a complete description of, you know, when you might want the assets to be distributed outright to the children, what you might want them to be used for before they're responsible enough for that. So naming the trust as a beneficiary of the life insurance policy is one option there. Other than that, it would be to set up some sort of a restrictive account in which the child was named as a beneficiary and there was somebody who you could trust to keep an eye on the money for them. But, you know, as far as the most complete and whole picture when it comes to laying out exactly how you'd like your children to be provided for with the proceeds of that life insurance fund, I would recommend a trust.
Could this be done through the will, for example, something like a testamentary trust?
Yes, absolutely. That's a great point, because if this particular couple is, you know, they have limited resources, so this couple may have decided to use money that they could have spent on setting up some sort of legal document that they didn't find particularly necessary, they could definitely instead just prepare a simple will that lays out a testamentary trust for the benefit of their children. That's a great point.
All right, let's take the same couple now. Fast forward 10, 15 years later, they're established. They now own a house. Their 401k programs or IRAs are substantially worth more. Now they have two or three kids. What would be different for this couple now, fast forwarding 15 years, where they have accumulated assets, substantial assets in many cases, where, you know, maybe they bought a house, the house is appreciated, their 401k with matching contributions could be sometimes six figures. And I've seen young tech executives in their 30s that are worth seven figures as a result of stock. I mean, we have a Facebook client who's worth a lot of money just as a result of stock, and yet at a young age. So what do you do 10, 15 years later? Would you do anything different than, let's say, what you did when you first got married?
I would. You know, we just talked about how creating a testamentary trust through a will could work really well for that couple that we described early on in their marriage. Now, here, a testamentary trust wouldn't serve this couple further down the road as well as it might, you know, earlier in their relationship. Because as your readers may be aware, anytime we're dealing just with a trust, we're going to have to deal with probate in order to transfer those assets according to the terms of the trust. So this couple, as they start to acquire more assets, needs to be setting up a living trust. And they need to be paying close attention to how their different assets are titled. They need to be making sure that those assets are held in their own names as trustees of the trust. And they need to really be paying attention to the potential penalty that they could face for not transferring those assets into their trust during their lifetime. Now, you also mentioned retirement accounts. And so they should be paying, again, close attention to the beneficiary designations. There's some real benefits of naming your surviving spouse as the primary beneficiary of a retirement account. There's some tax advantages to doing that. So that should always be one of the first things in mind. But after that, you know, if both of the spouses were to pass away at the same time or something like that, then they need to be making sure that they have a conduit trust provision or some sort of a stretch out provision in their trust so that if they're leaving behind young kids, they want to make sure that they don't have to pay out that full retirement account within the first 5 years, which it's a penalty that's imposed at times when people haven't considered the stretch out trust provision.
I want to take another scenario. Up until this time, we've been talking about a young couple or a married couple. Let's change sides a little bit and take that to a single individual, male or female, or say, for example, as we see so often today, as a result of divorce, you see a single parent household. Maybe the wife got custody of the kids. She has some assets. She's in charge of the kids, has custody of those kids. What would you do in that situation if you were a single individual or a single parent?
That's a great question, and I'm sure one that could apply to many of your listeners. One of the first documents that I would really get into place there is a nomination of guardian. And you know, these parents and parents in general spend so much time caring for their kids, looking out for them, making sure that they're provided for. But one of the things that oftentimes slips our minds is that we need to identify who that person is that we would want to look after our minor children after we pass away. And so in this case, and this is a very positive thing just based on the way that life actually works, it's possible to nominate a guardian after you pass away, one, to care for the person of your child, so to look after the person on a day-to-day basis, make sure they make it to school on time, that they're, you know, clean, happy, and fed. And, you know, if that person, let's say they're a grandma or a sister or a brother, and they may not be the best when it comes to finances, it's entirely normal to nominate a second guardian of the estate of the minor child. And so that allows you to identify that person who you don't necessarily want to have looking out for your children on a day-to-day basis as far as their personal needs are concerned, but you definitely trust them to keep an eye on the long-term financial aspects of their lives. And so that's called a split guardian nomination, in which you nominate a guardian of the person and a guardian of the estate. Now, if you're lucky enough to know a single person who can fulfill both of those roles, then by all means, nominate that person to act in both capacities. But knowing that you can split up those duties is one of the really nice things about a guardian nomination.
And then let's take that same situation in the case of a divorce. Let's say that there were substantial assets that are held by that single parent along with children. Anything different you would do in that situation?
I would just want to make sure that there was, you know, very clear instructions in their testamentary documents as far as a living trust was concerned. Now, one of the things that a single parent is going to have to spend more time thinking about than a married couple, in which, you know, they kind of default to the surviving spouse to look after the children after one of the spouses were to pass away, is they're going to need to spend more time thinking about who's going to act in that trustee position. And depending on the assets that are in the trust, if it's going to be a substantial amount of assets, they should be thinking about who's going to be able to manage those effectively and efficiently over the long term. And so, you know, private professional fiduciaries oftentimes can serve in that role very well, both due to their professional expertise, but also due to the fact that they have a little bit of separation or distance from the family, which gives them enough space to really think calmly and clearly about what's best for these children's financial futures.
You know, this is something that we use in our own practice with our clients, Adam, as we are recommending in using professional fiduciaries, not only as a backup trustee, guardian, as you just mentioned, because a lot of times what we come across is individuals will set up a trust and they'll say, well, you know, let's say husband, something happens to the husband, the wife assumes trusteeship. And what happens later on if she becomes incapacitated, you know, then you see them name children who may live in other states, may not be qualified, or they name brothers or sisters who live in other locations and may not be familiar with all the complexities of distributing the estate, filing the 706 return, the final income tax return, distributing the assets. I mean, this is a time-consuming procedure that takes place, and it can be quite complex at times, depending on how the assets of the estate are held and the composition of those assets and the structure of the estate.
It really is. And I know that we've both seen this in our careers. And one of the things that I find really unfortunate is when a lot of work and thought is put into the planning process. And while the parent is alive and well, they're able to, you know, work with their advisor, their financial advisor, or work with their attorney or other professionals that they trust, and they're able to really lay out a plan that's going to serve their children very well if they're not there to look after them. But, you know, as you identified, that plan is only as good as the person who is identified to execute it. And so what we've seen, and it's really unfortunate when we see this, is that there's well-meaning family members who just don't understand the terms of the trust correctly, or maybe they don't understand the level of diligence or vigilance that it really takes to keep an eye on the business of the trust. And so somebody who can serve in a professional capacity is very useful, both because of their ability to understand the document and to transact the business. But, you know, one of the other benefits that we've seen is that it kind of frees up that aunt or that uncle, that close family friend, to keep the relationship with the children on a personal basis rather than a transactional or a business basis. And that's a real benefit to those children who may have, you know, lost a parent or loved one, being able to kind of keep those roles separate.
I wonder if this can address some of the issues that we're also running across with elder abuse, with children and a surviving spouse. I never used to see that 15, 20 years ago, but we see it more frequently today, Adam. And then also what can become sibling rivalry. Many times you will see parents, because maybe they have three or four kids, one child is not doing as well, so they want to make special provisions for that child, or one of the children has come upon hardship. You know, the parents are feeling, boy, we want to take extra special care to help that child who has more need than his or her more successful brothers and sisters. So what about that kind of situation?
Yeah, you know, and it's really a shame because we are seeing a lot of elder abuse, and I don't think that anybody ever really suspects, you know, when they're feeling good and feeling healthy, that they're going to be the victim of it, or that, their children may end up perpetrating it. And you know what I think is interesting for some of your listeners to consider is that, you know, what we see that constitutes elder abuse, sometimes it's just out and out malfeasance. You know, there's no way to call it other than what they did was just wrong and dishonest. However, you know, there's plenty of other times where, let's say a child is more involved in caring for the parent. They're spending a lot of extra time. Sometimes they spend their own money and they start to get a feeling like they're entitled to this, or they feel like they're the ones who are caring for it. So, you know, why not kind of take care of this expense out of mom and dad's account? Or maybe they're playing it by the book, but there's a suspicious child out there who suspects that the child who's closer to the parents on a day-to-day basis might be doing something like that. And so before moving on, I just say that to highlight the fact that sometimes when we see our clients who are victims of elder abuse, it's not necessarily because they have bad kids. So I know that it's real easy for you to think, well, you know, my kids are great. They wouldn't do that. But as you identified, sometimes sibling rivalries or pre-existing relationships can taint the way that they see these sorts of acts of care for their parents. And so bringing in a professional at that point, it safeguards some of our elderly clients from the out-and-out malfeasance or theft that I mentioned at the top, but it also safeguards the relationships between some of the siblings because those sorts of concerns about potentially questionable activities just aren't part of the equation anymore.
I want to move on to another type of situation. We talked about a young couple starting out, and then as they grow, maybe acquire more assets, start a family, have children. We talked about single parents, and then also providing for issues upon death, such as, you know, avoiding elder abuse and other issues. Let's move forward to taking that same couple. But in this situation, they're very successful. Husband had a successful business, or maybe both husband and wife had successful careers. And you're now talking about substantial amounts of assets that go beyond the estate tax exemption. Let's talk about some of the things that somebody, we'll call them Mr. and Mrs. Larry Lots of Bucks.
Mr. and Mrs. Lots of Bucks present their own challenges. Now, definitely, they've been fortunate in their life, and they find themselves in a position where their basic needs are covered, right? Like, they know that they don't have to worry about their housing, shelter, and food. But one of the real concerns is that once they exceed the current exemption amount, which, as your listeners are aware, is $5.4 million, it's going to be subject to the estate tax at the highest possible rate. So at that point, their concern isn't so much holding on to the assets that they have to make sure that their basic needs are covered, but it starts to become, how can we transfer these assets out of our estate, you know, before they're subject to the estate tax? And so I just want to start with one of the most simple and straightforward ways that Mr. and Mrs. Lots of Bucks can approach this task, and that's annual gifting, as well as using their lifetime gift amount of $5.43 million per person. So I say annual gifting. So as your readers may be aware, and your listeners, that is, each person can give $14,000 per person to as many persons as they want every single year. So Mr. and Mrs. Lots of Bucks should regularly, on an annual basis, every year when they do their taxes, they should be making these annual gifts, these annual tax-free gifts. So Mr. Lots of Bucks can give $14,000 to each one of his children, grandchildren, other persons, and Mrs. Lots of Bucks can give another $14,000 to each recipient. Now, you know, we have plenty of people who they may want to benefit who aren't really able to manage that amount of money. They aren't necessarily old enough to be trusted with it. So not only can they give it to them, but they can also transfer that money outside of their estate by putting it into an irrevocable trust for the benefit of that particular person. And, you know, they can even set up a single irrevocable trust that benefits multiple persons, and it's still eligible for the gift for each one of the beneficiaries. So if they're able to think about that, it's never even too late to start, because that's a lot of money that you can move out of your estate. You know, and then beyond that, they can make a lifetime transfer of $5.43 million per person. And, you know, they can focus on assets that have a current value that they anticipate may increase rapidly in the future, or just, you know, they're confident that they'll keep their value and go up. Those are great candidates as far as assets are concerned to transfer out of the estate so that the future appreciation isn't going to be taxed on their death. And then, you know, I just want to squeeze in one more thing. That annual lifetime amount is indexed for inflation, which means it's going to increase every year. Last year, as you're aware, it was $5.34 million. This year, it's $5.43. So each year, they can give away that additional amount that it's increased year by year. So they're able to factor that into their annual giving as well.
I follow a lot of what happens in the estate planning world, especially with larger estates. And one of the nation's wealthiest families, the Walton family, Sam Walton, back before he passed away, recognized that Walmart was on this great growth trajectory as a company. And he gave away the majority of his personal holdings of Walmart stock to his kids, paid the tax up front, because he knew that Walmart was expanding rapidly and that his own stock holdings would be worth even more. And this was back when the exemption, I think, was only $1 million, and the estate tax rates are, I think, around 50%. But it's one reason today that the four or five members of the Walton family collectively are worth over $100 billion.
That's a great example. And, you know, you also mentioned the fact that he was able to pay any tax that may have been due on that gift from his own estate, which if the tax is going to be due, he's able to transfer that extra amount out of his estate, you know, because Mr. and Mrs. Lotsabucks at this point are interested in, you know, transferring as much as they can while you're alive. And I feel like the present day version of Mr. Walton may be somebody like your client that you mentioned who works with Facebook. You know, if people have tech stocks or other stocks, maybe it's a closely held corporation or a private company that may be going public in the future, getting that outside of their estate before an initial public offering or before it really starts to attract a lot of attention is a great way to get an asset that has a currently low value out of the estate before it just really starts to skyrocket.
Let's go back to Larry Lotsabucks, and let's just say, you know, he's not Donald Trump, but let's say he's worth 30, 40, 50 million. You know that the exemption is 5.4 million, multiply that times two, so you got 10.8. It would seem to me if the Lotsabucks had enough money to live on, they're never going to have to worry about income. It would make a lot of sense either to get the assets out of the estate through a gifting program, or let's talk about another approach that is often used when the husband and wife want to keep the assets, and that is something called a wealth replacement trust, which is funded with life insurance with the premiums paid through gifting.
That's a great point. So, you know, the old line that nothing's sure except for death and taxes. Well, I feel like that's almost an advertisement for a wealth replacement trust. You know, Mr. and Mrs. Lotsabucks know that they want to hold on to these assets during their life. And, you know, they also know that the estate taxes is not likely to go anywhere anytime soon. So what they're able to do is plan for that in the future. And by taking the time and allocating the necessary amount of funds to purchase a life insurance policy that's purchased with paying the estate tax in mind, I mean, it's just a great way to deal with a cost that you know is coming. And so, why is a wealth replacement trust necessary? Why does it need to be a trust instead of, why can't they just purchase that life insurance policy and keep it inside of their estate? And that's because, as some of your listeners may be aware, that death benefit that will be paid on their death is included in their taxable estate. So what they need to do is make sure that they set up this irrevocable wealth replacement trust or an irrevocable life insurance trust. You know, they set it up outside of their estate. It's irrevocable. And then they make a gift to that trust on a annual basis in order to pay the premiums that come due. And since it was the trust that purchased the policy and not the individuals, that's an important element. It's already going to be outside of their estate by the time that the death benefit is paid. And, you know, that's a great way to really take a real bite out of the estate tax that will eventually be due in the case of Mr. and Mrs. Lotsabucks.
You know, one of the things that we know that we need to do from a health perspective is every year we go see our doctors and we get an annual physical to see that, you know, everything is okay with us health-wise. As an estate planning attorney, how often do you recommend estate planning documents be reviewed? I mean, I could think of if, let's say, you've had a sudden windfall, maybe, you know, like our client at Facebook, you know, his options and things are worth a lot of money, an inheritance comes into play, maybe more children. How often do you usually recommend in your practice that people review their estate plan?
That's exactly it. Significant life event, as you identified, that's a great time to check in with your estate planning attorney. You know, your estate planning attorney, he or she is going to be familiar with your plan. They may not necessarily be familiar with your assets or at least the current state of your assets. So you need to make sure that when you do check in, you give them a complete update. You know, you can really trust them. They have your interest at mind. You know, you are entitled to attorney-client confidentiality. So really just lay it all out there for them so they know. But, you know, if we're not necessarily dealing with some sort of a life event, then I would recommend checking in about every 3 years or so, maybe every 2 to 5 years. And that doesn't necessarily mean a big, long meeting with your estate planning attorney, but it's checking in with them on the phone, letting them know what's been going on, and just, you know, asking, like, should we get together and meet? And sometimes they'll say, yeah, you know, there's been some changes in the law, and I think we need to talk about the current status of your estate plan, or they'll say, you know, it's been pretty smooth sailing since you last call, and let's talk again in 3 years.
Well, listen, Adam, great information. As we close, if our listeners would like to find out about the work that your law firm does in estate planning, how could they do so?
You can find us on the internet at andersonyocum.com. That's Anderson, YOCUM.com. And I'm available by email at ASHERRY@andersonyocum.com.
Adam, well, listen, as always, thanks for coming on the program.
Thank you very much for having me. It was a pleasure.
You know, Jim, when you talk about estate planning, you always think of one of these situations in the movie where somebody's reading a will after somebody dies at great age, and, you know, and everybody's wondering what they get, and then the plot's off and running from there. But in reality, in today's world, estate planning is something even people who are just starting out in life can do. In other words, even if you're just married and you haven't even had kids yet, you can anticipate this in the direction everything is going. And the one thing that's really important is for people to have at least a will, but it's much more important to follow the estate planning through.
Absolutely. I mean, as you talked about, even a young couple starting out should have a will. They should have durable powers of attorney, durable medical powers. It came to my attention this week. One of the individuals that appears on a lot of the cable stations, or this one particular station, her husband was killed in a bicycle thon or some kind of race at a very young age. So things like this happen. And we see this, John, not only just with young couples, we see these kind of tragedies, but we also see elder abuse today. And not to mention the fact that if you're fortunate enough to accumulate some assets, you should consider having an estate plan to help distribute them to make sure that those assets are preserved, protected, and distributed in the way that you want upon your passing. But anyway, I hope there was enough information there. I don't know what your particular situation is listening to the program, whether you're single, just starting out in life, or you happen to be one of Larry Lotsabuck's friends. In the meantime, on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on Lifetime Income. Until you and I talk again, well, we hope you have a pleasant week.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense NewsHour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries, or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSN. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense NewsHour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the NewsHour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.